This is Second Look. I'm Bob Levicky, WMRA's news director. Great to be with you on this lovely Sunday afternoon. Stay with us. We've got a lot to cover and learn about from the week's news, including Bee Health in Virginia, a doctor who will treat you without insurance, the fight over gerrymandering, 50th anniversary celebration of Dr. King's speech against the Vietnam War, and the week in Virginia politics. But first, let's start with our preview of this weekend's Shenandoah Fringe Festival. It's happening today and tomorrow in Stanton, so you might want to check it out. At Fringe Fest, so-called Fringeketeers showcase their work in a demonstration of the Queen City's artistic muscle. WMRA's Jesse Nadler caught up with the festival's Grand High Poobah for a preview.
Carmel Clavin, a longtime performer and producer, would really prefer to sidestep the whole Murphy's Law thing.
But you can't get sick. No dairy for the next 7 days.
Upstairs at the Kettle Performance Space in downtown Stanton, Clavin is wrapping up a final meeting with her technical director of the second annual Shenandoah Fringe Festival.
It depends on my mood. So on all of my Shen Fringe communications, it says Directrix and Grand High Poobah Extraordinaire.
If you didn't get that, Clavin is the brains behind the two-day festival, a showcase of theatrical performances by magicians, dancers, DJs, clowns, actors, vaudeville historians, even shadow puppeteers, drawn to Stanton's oddball art scene. Collagists, painters, and photographers are in the mix as well. One artist plans to erect a tower downtown and sit on it for 24 hours to draw attention to homelessness. The disparate acts are an outgrowth of Clavin's own eclectic performance style.
I have been a belly dancer and a henna artist and a singer and an actor and a living doll and a stage fighter and a costumer, and I've worked medieval fairs, and I realized I like to do all the things, and no specific place is enough for me, so I realized that if I want to do all the things, then I need to work in vaudeville.
One actor coming to Shen Fringe is Heather Massey of New York City, who will be performing her one-woman show about 1930s film siren Hedy Lamarr. A lot of people don't know this, but Hedy Lamarr was also a brilliant inventor.
I see the failings in the operations of the stoplight, and I design one that will operate more efficiently and safely for the modern driver.
Lamarr co-developed a radio guidance system for Allied torpedoes during World War II. She invented technology that's still used in cell phones to this day. Massey, who has won awards for her performance, was drawn to Lamarr because they both share a background in science.
I went to the University of Virginia for astrophysics, and I got my theater degree from Virginia Tech. Teddy just didn't fit into the regular mold. She wasn't what people expected.
Clavin says it's hard to imagine the festival anywhere but in Stanton.
Stanton has been growing its arts community for years and years and years, like decades. The community is here and the patronage is here for the arts. The festival works beautifully here because the pump has already been primed.
The festival runs from Sunday to Monday.
To address the fact that there's an entire population of people who work retail, service, and hospitality who don't know what a Saturday-Sunday weekend is.
She says attendance to Monday's lineup last year dipped slightly from Sunday, but not by much. And a lot of the patrons who turned out paid with cash.
Which means to me, having worked in the service industry for so long, like, great, that means we've got bartenders, waitresses, and strippers. Like, excellent.
Fringe buttonholders are also invited to a couple of parties Sunday and Monday nights post-performances. There's the BS Awards Sunday night, where performers walk away with ridiculous prizes for distinctions like most likely to poke out an eye, which are made up on the spot. I'm Jesse Nadler.
Jesse has also been following the fight over the practice of gerrymandering in Virginia. Last week, a Richmond Circuit Court judge ruled against a group challenging 11 of Virginia's districts for disenfranchising black voters and favoring Republicans. Another case on the issue is still pending. Jesse talked to redistricting reform proponents who are also trying to find a solution by working with state lawmakers.
Of the 122 Virginia legislators who ran for re-election in 2015, guess how many won? 122. Not a single incumbent lost their bid for re-election. Coincidence? Hardly. Critics say it's mostly due to gerrymandering, in which legislators redraw district lines to ensure they're packed with voters necessary to stay in power.
I'm sorry to quote the president, but the elections are rigged.
Chris Gavaller is a member of the activist group 50 Ways Rockbridge in Lexington, and gerrymandering has become his number one rallying cry. Here he is speaking at a mock town hall in Vinton in February for 6th District Republican Congressman Bob Goodlatte, who has declined to meet in such a face-to-face forum for several years.
Now, a lot of folks start falling asleep when you say the word gerrymandering because it sounds complicated, but this is actually the key of everything.
He points out that Virginia votes purple, splitting votes pretty evenly between Republicans and Democrats. But that is not at all reflected in the state's legislative makeup.
Our House of Delegates has a supermajority of Republicans 2-1. And they've done that strictly through gerrymandering. It is legal because they write the laws.
Both sides are equally guilty of gerrymandering, depending on who's in power at the time of the U.S. Census, when districts are redrawn every decade. The last census was in 2010, and time is running out for a fix before the next one in 2020. Virginia's constitution requires that districts be, quote, compact and contiguous, unquote. That means their shape is supposed to resemble something close to rectangles and squares. But 11 districts in the Commonwealth look anything but. Some have been described as a toilet bowl seat and a snake that's been run over by a car. These crazy-looking districts are the focus of a lawsuit brought by the redistricting reform group One Virginia 2021. Defendants in the case include the State Board of Elections and the Republican-controlled House of Delegates. The core issue, according to One Virginia, is whether compactness means anything at all, or just anything the legislature says it does.
The only people we find that aren't really gung-ho on redistricting reform are the legislators themselves. It's the batter wanting to call his own balls and strikes, and I think we need to get an umpire in there and some clear rules.
Brian Cannon is an attorney and executive director of One Virginia 2021.
What you see when our legislative bodies cease to represent us, which is where we are today, and they cease to be able to function, which is where we are today, then we get executive orders proliferating that either one side of America or the other side of America hates. We get an expansion of the presidency well beyond what our founders intended, and we get people who disengaged and distrust our government. That's a recipe for the demise of our republic.
A lawyer for the House of Delegates in the case argued that the same criteria was used to draw the district boundaries as in previous years. Therefore, it's not gerrymandering. Meanwhile, voters are pressing their delegates to take a position on gerrymandering. Gavaller met with 8-term Republican delegate Ben Klein of Rockbridge in mid-March.
He does seem open to what I think is a clear fact. Currently, the districts are unfair and the process of creating them is unfair. He told me that he saw there was a lot of room for improvement, and that to me is a very good start.
They each gave the other homework.
He asked me to come back next time with some specific proposals, and I asked him to investigate what would it actually take to get a bill through the House of Delegates and actually onto the floor for a vote and passed into law.
In an email, Delegate Klein said he is always willing to meet with constituents. But he and Republican Dickie Bell of Highland County both declined to comment on redistricting. Republican delegates Tony Wilt of Rockingham and Steve Landis of Albemarle did not respond to requests for comment. For WMRA News, I'm Jesse Nadler.
Conservationists, farmers, researchers, and others are concerned about several bee species in Virginia as their populations decline here and across the country. Some scientists have been setting bee traps from Charlottesville to northern Virginia to find where they are and why they're dying out. WMRA's Miranda Bennett joins the search for one species, the rusty-patched bumblebee.
Ty Rolston had never actually seen one with his own eyes, but the minute he saw the corpse, he knew what it was. But he's a scientist, so just to be sure.
You know, took it and put it under the microscope and looked, and, you know, sure enough, that's what it was.
When Rolston found this bumblebee in Sky Meadow State Park, east of Winchester, back in 2014, he knew it had been 20 years since this species had been spotted in the region. In other words, for this bee biologist at the University of Virginia, finding this tiny bee was significant.
We put out the word that we had found one, in the region. So it was pretty big.
But the excitement didn't last long. Ty and his colleagues returned to Sky Meadows the following year in 2015, but they didn't find any bees. Decades ago, the Rusty Patch were one of the most common bumblebees in Virginia, but then their population started declining in the 1990s.
So there are various things that stress all the bee populations, but why this one, as well as several of the other ones, are declining steeply, I'm pretty confident is disease, and it's probably from this fungal disease called Nosema.
Wild bumblebees across the country are suffering from this disease, but the impact on the Rusty Patch was particularly severe. Last month, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service designated the Rusty Patch bumblebee an endangered species.
Why the Rusty Patch was hit even more than the other declining species, nobody knows. We don't know what other factors made it even more susceptible.
In other words, the fungal disease alone does not explain the decline nationally in numbers of bumblebees, honeybees, butterflies, all the pollinators, in fact.
Honeybees also suffer quite a lot of diseases and varroa mites and various diseases, but the one thing honeybees have is people working for them.
One of those people is Amanda Welch, a beekeeper in Louisa.
It's a nice hum. They change their pitch when they get pissed.
Really?
Yeah.
You can tell.
Yeah. That's just a nice calm. I was a little bit like, what's that? What's that? But it wasn't like, get out of here!
Unlike bumblebees, honeybees are not native to the U.S. They arrived with the colonists in Jamestown, and now they're shipped around the country to pollinate crops as they flower. But their work for the agriculture system is blamed, in part, for their decline.
They started injecting pesticides into the seed that were systemic and get into the entire plant. But there's also trace amounts in the nectar and in the pollen, and the bees would take that back to the hive, and it ends up building up in the hive. And it also will weaken their immune system so that then when another disease comes in that kills the bees.
It's likely a combination of pesticides, disease, and loss of habitat that's causing the decline in bee species across the state. Both Welch and Ralston stress that humans do have a role to play in saving these pollinators. Broadly, that might mean changing our agriculture system, but on a smaller scale, we can plant more wildflowers.
With bumblebees, we pretty much have to make a safe environment out there for them and then hope they find a way to keep themselves going.
While beekeepers like Amanda Welch work to bolster the honeybees, Ty Ralston keeps studying their wild cousins, ever hopeful that someday, somewhere, he'll spot a second Rusty Patch bumblebee. For WMRA News, I'm Miranda Bennett.
Last Tuesday marked 50 years since Martin Luther King Jr. gave what is considered his most controversial speech against the war in Vietnam. WMRA's Christopher Clymer-Kurtz reports how some in Harrisonburg honored that message.
The Revolution of Values event drew about 30 people to Harrisonburg's Liberty Park Tuesday in hopes of reminding people of Dr. King's message and the still unfinished work he described 50 years ago in his Beyond Vietnam speech. King Salim Kalfani is former Virginia State Conference NAACP Executive Director.
Unless the people rise up as Dwight David Eisenhower implored us as he was leaving office, the military-industrial complex will control all of our money and will have us in wars all around the world. And that's true to this day. So we've got work to do. Let's get busy.
Stephen Thomas of the Northeast Neighborhood Association in Harrisonburg led part of a call-and-response reading of Dr. King's speech.
We must rapidly begin the shift from a thing-oriented society to a person-oriented society.
When machines and computers, profit motives and property rights are considered more important than people, the giant triplets of racism, extreme materialism, and militarism are incapable of being conquered.
The Harrisonburg Field Office of the U.S. Department of Arts and Culture, which calls itself a people-powered movement dedicated to cultivating empathy, equity, and social imagination, and is not an official government agency, co-hosted the event, along with a handful of other local groups.
Christopher also brought us the story of one general practitioner in Harrisonburg who works outside the health insurance system. It's not so much a statement about the system or a model for how it should be fixed. Instead, it's more like a doctor just arrived at his own approach, sidestepping convention and filling a niche. Christopher paid a visit, and here's his report.
Dr. Andrew Blay is dressed for his work day in white sneakers, jeans, a long-sleeve shirt, as he enters the house that he converted into Cook's Creek Clinic. It's just feet from noisy Route 42 traffic south of Harrisonburg.
You can leave that open, yeah. It's a little more inviting.
Is this Becky, my nurse?
Blay and Becky Taylor have worked together for 37 years in emergency rooms, a family practice, urgent care, and this clinic, where they are the only staff and only make same-day appointments and take walk-ins.
Let me get a diet. Do you want a Diet Coke?
No, thank you.
I generally have one in the morning.
Last week, Virginia Public Radio reported on a direct primary care model for general practitioners in which people pay a monthly fee to their doctors in exchange for medical care as they need it, insurance middlemen aside. Dr. Blay's clinic takes a slightly different approach. In addition to not accepting insurance, it also doesn't have members, just a flat $50 per visit fee.
It's so simple that a lot of people get confused. I mean, they're not sure how. Are you sure it's going to work? I mean, it's just...
About 50 to 60 patients visit each week. The kitchen in the old house serves as the check-in, check-out room. Personal photos cover the cupboards. A handwritten sign above where the stove used to be says Becky's office, and the credit card reader sits on the counter next to the sink. Elsewhere in the house is the waiting room with wicker rocking chairs, two small exam rooms, a baby-gated stairway that leads up to Blay's office and his dog Sammy's daytime hangout. Oh, and how many computers?
None. It's all paperwork.
It's a model that has worked for him.
I thought maybe if I charge a fair price, keep it simple, give people the time, listen a little bit, the business end of it may take care of itself. I may be able to handle that. It's worked. It really has. It's not overwhelming, which is good for me because I get to spend a little time with people. You feel like at the end of the day, you probably took care of those things that needed to be taken care of that day.
Timothy Jost is a retired law professor who writes for the health policy journal Health Affairs and lives just outside of Harrisonburg. He said that Blaze Clinic and other walk-in options, like those offered in some states by Walmart or CVS, do offer a useful service in a niche.
There are a lot of uninsured people in the United States, even after the Affordable Care Act, and a lot of them, are looking for discounted care. In a sense, it's one of the reasons, I think, why we don't have a single-payer system in the United States and why there's so many people who remain uninsured, because a lot of them have kind of worked out various kinds of informal arrangements that work for them.
However, he says, those arrangements aren't the answer to all the problems of the nation's healthcare system.
If you get cancer and need serious chemotherapy, he's probably not going to be able to do that for you, and you're certainly not going to be able to get the drugs at an affordable price unless you have some kind of insurance coverage.
To serve patients, Blay relies on his decades of experience. He doesn't have ready access to extensive lab work or MRIs and the like. He sends people with immediate pressing needs to the emergency room. If they have a chronic need, they have to find a different primary care physician. A lot of the time, though, people just need simple things, a tetanus shot or a mole checked.
What's happened through the week?
Just more of the same. I mean, fever's been the main thing. Every time I get off ibuprofen or something, it just spikes
back
up.
Back up again.
Yeah.
Dairy farmer Chris Showalter was a walk-in with flu symptoms.
It's hard to milk cows and be sick. if you can get something to help me, that's what I'm after.
Well, that's the unusual part.
At the end of the visit, Dr. Blay takes Showalter to the kitchen. Nurse Taylor processes the credit card payment.
Thank you.
Beside her, Blay writes a prescription.
Here's your script, Chris.
All right. Thank you.
Blay's board certification expired about a decade ago when he says he chose not to shell out cash for a renewal. He also says he can't afford malpractice insurance and so doesn't carry it. But that doesn't bother Showalter. I called him a few days after his visit.
Doesn't concern me. I don't have insurance either.
About a third of the clinic's patients are like Showalter, who carries a card that says his old order Mennonite church will pay if he can't. His recent spur-of-the-moment visit and prescription did the trick for him.
Yeah, I feel good. Took care of it.
In this case, perhaps you could say like doctor, like patient, each operating in a broader context, but with their own priorities that, underneath a nation roiled in debate and change, seem to be working just fine. For WMRA News, I'm Christopher Clymer-Kurtz.
Let's wrap up with some analysis of the week in Virginia politics. Craig Carper with our partner station WCVE in Richmond sat down with Jeff Shapiro, political columnist at the Richmond Times-Dispatch.
Jeff, it's been a busy week in Virginia politics and national politics and the place where they intersect. The veto session has come and gone. Governor McAuliffe this year set an all-time record. 111 most bills ever vetoed by a governor.
That's 111 over his administration, 40 in this
session of the legislature. All of those vetoes have stood. All of those vetoes are standing, in large part because the Republicans don't have a veto-proof majority in the House of Delegates. They're seat shy, and they are 6 seats shy in the Senate.
And staying true to form, Governor Terry McAuliffe once again proposing an expansion of the state's Medicaid program, Republicans once again rejecting it.
And I think this falls in the category we just discussed, an election year talking point, very important to both parties. The governor's position is that with the collapse of Republican efforts in Washington to repeal and replace Obamacare, that Obamacare is here to stay, and that Virginia should get in on the feed to use these additional Medicaid dollars to expand Obamacare. We're talking about over $2 billion a year. That would take a lot of pressure off of the Virginia budget. Of course, the Republicans argue that one can't rely on Washington to pay these bills indefinitely, and that Virginia would only end up with some bigger, more unmanageable expenses relative to, as Doug Wilder would put it, the provision of health care for the aged, the poor, and the infirmed.
And Dave Albo, the chairman of the House Courts of Justice Committee, is stepping down from the House of Delegates after 24 years.
A Northern Virginia moderate Republican. Republicans from Northern Virginia are rare. Moderate Republicans are even rarer, at least from Virginia at large. He's the chairman of the Courts Committee. He says he's giving up after more than two decades because he just can't afford to remain in politics. Albo's seat looks like a Democratic pickup and will likely as well result in this big shuffle within the House over the control of the Courts Committee. Looks like a conservative Republican from Charlottesville, Albemarle, Rob Bell, is going to take that job.
And thanks to Jeff Shapiro, political columnist at the Richmond Times-Dispatch. Jeff, we will catch up again next week.
Support for WMRA's News and Information Fund, which makes our award-winning coverage possible, is provided by Bibb and Dolly Frazier, Les and Johnny Grady, Klein May Realty, Eugene Stoltzfus Architects, Joy Loving, Janet Trettner, Pam and Jim Huggins, and by a grant from a donor-advised fund of the Community Foundation of Harrisonburg and Rockingham County. If you'd like to learn more about how we fund our news and how you can help, go to WMRA.org, mouse over news. Then click on News and Information Fund. Find all of our stories from the newsroom at WMRA.org. And be sure to click like on Facebook at WMRA Public Radio. And follow me on Twitter at WMRA News to get the latest on our coverage. I'm Bob Levicki, WMRA's News Director and Morning Edition host. Enjoy the rest of your Sunday.